Okay, if I can announce today's speaker and introduce him to you. It's Zane Dangle, and he brings 20 years of experience across a range of fields related to government, the United Nations, and civil society. Before taking over as DG of DIRCO in 2022, he had previously been a special advisor to ministers in the department, and prior to that, he had been a DG in the Department of Social Development and also a special advisor. His career has also taken him to the UN Population Fund and to the Human Rights Law Group in Washington, where he worked on transitional justice. He also served here in South Africa as COO at Soul City, an important NGO in the social justice sector. More recently, Mr. Dangle has played a role in South Africa's proceedings before the ICJ and has more generally been a prominent voice on the role of the Global South in a more just international order. So Mr. Dangle will address the club on how South Africa can negotiate current and future turbulence in the global environment. That's a very cautious question. And after that, he will take questions from the media and from the rest of you. So if I can welcome Mr. Dangle.
Thanks, Anthony. Good afternoon, everybody. I think I've made numerous presentations to the UN General Assembly and also the UN Security Council, but some of you more nervous in this room. So in terms of the question, it may be useful, and firstly to thank the Cape Town Press Club for inviting me. It's an honor. Just to share some thoughts on this. And it's interesting enough, it's the third time that I'm doing a similar presentation in the last 3 weeks. The first one on this particular topic was to the Government of National Unity's clearinghouse, which was the first time that I had the opportunity to engage with them outside of a cabinet environment. Then also with cabinet, but also with the diplomatic corps in different parts of the world. So, members of the diplomatic corps, good afternoon. And so perhaps it's a good starting point is what is the geopolitical landscape, this turbulent landscape that the question refers to. At the beginning of 2026 at Davos, Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, spoke of a rupture in the international system. And he attributed that rupture to the stance of a global hegemon. And there's always been global hegemons in the international community. But I think the approach that he was stating was that there was a shift in the manner in which one of the major powers in the world, and if you want to use a hegemon, was now also engaging with the transatlantic alliance. So for many of us, it's the rupture we agree with, we see the rupture, we agree with what Prime Minister Carney says, but the global South had felt the impact of hegemons long before the last 5 or 6 years. We can talk more about the nature of that rupture with some of the transatlantic diplomats here, but suffice to say it was a significant subject for discussion when we were in Davos, when national security advisors from Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East met. This was the topic of discussion. How do we reverse as a collective of states in this difficult environment? So it's not just a question for South Africa. I think it's a question that is being asked and perhaps not answered globally. So it's not undiplomatic to say that the president of the US in his second term has brought an unprecedented challenge to the customs and rules of the international legal order and the institutions that safeguard it. Some have called it a lawless approach, so I'll use that as a way of describing it. But it stems from, in many instances, a particular ideological or theoretical stance in international relations. I think there's some realists around the table, which is, you know, a realist notion that the international system is completely anarchic, and that the state should be the primary actor, and that primary actor should seek to ensure its own survival. And so that notion and that approach to realism, and it's not one that I agree with in terms of the way it's being defined, seems to discourage cooperation, it seems to discourage interdependence, but moves back to sphere of influence politics, and where power defines who calls the shots. Okay. So we see that in many instances. I'll come to the peace and security issues now, but we see that in trade relations. We see that in terms of how resources of countries are being looked at as not something that you engage with from an interdependent perspective, but something that you can take and take by force if necessary, if negotiations fail. Okay. But there's also been, so I think the trade issues, and particularly for South Africans over the last 2 years, has been a topical discussion because of the unilateral trade tariffs that was imposed, not just on us, but globally, but we were quite concerned about the impact on us. But there's also been a significant number of interstate wars. Before 2022, we were in this space where we said that the previous 30 years were the most peaceful in human history, and that's an indictment on humanity. If the period, the 30 years leading up to 2022 was described as the most peaceful, because in Africa, in the Middle East, there were constant wars, constant conflicts. Europe was spared in those 30 years from wars and conflict, and that changed, and I'll come to that. Okay. Perhaps maybe I should just jump to some of the examples of the wars and conflicts in 2026, but also going back to 2022. So, on the 3rd of January, we saw the unprecedented, what happened once before, but not in the manner in which it happened now, the kidnapping of a Venezuelan head of state by another state. So, whether the question that arises from that is whether that is allowed, when disagreements can lead to the use of force to take out a sitting head of state. And the notion of forcible democratization has always been on the agenda, and you know, diplomats have been speaking about it in terms of theories. What is the ways to achieve democratization? Is it through diplomacy? Is it through engagement? And that's our preferred route. But we now see that the use of force is becoming almost acceptable. We also saw an aggressive posture in relation to Europe and other parts of North America. So I was the G20 Sherpa last year for South Africa, and was also the G20 Sherpa since 2022, but was also participating for South Africa in Rome during the COVID period. South Africa and Brazil in India, when there was an impasse on how to deal with Ukraine in the G20, so South Africa and Brazil drafted language that stemmed from the UN Charter, and we shared that with the rest of the G20 and engaged with it. and it emerged as a unifying factor for a certain period of time. And it's not, it wasn't rocket science, it was really language directly from the UN Charter. And it said that there can be no annexation of land through the use of force or the threat of force. I'm not going to name the delegations of the G20 that kept us up negotiating that UN language. It was surprising that some of them felt that we should not be putting that in a G20 text. That same principles were repeated in Brazil, and it was then repeated in South Africa. But it took a lot of negotiating from two global South countries to assert the primacy of international law in a time when there was a bifurcation in terms of how international law and the charter was being looked at. The approach that we took in South Africa at that point was politics is nebulous. What can guide us is the certainty about what is permitted under the international legal system. Okay. But we've seen then the threat of force against Denmark, the threat of annexing Greenland, and that created the kind of discussions in Davos around the primacy of international law amongst South Africa, Middle Eastern countries, and essentially the EU states. But again, we've seen what we've seen today was the attack by the US and Israel on Iran. We describe that as a breach of the UN Charter, because the UN Charter is very clear in Article 2.4, which prohibits the threat or use of force against any state. The response by Iran by attacking its neighbors was also a breach of Article 51. And this is exactly what happened when the same attacks took place last year, and this was the same approach that we've taken. So you're seeing a lot more laissez-faire approaches to what is permissible with the use of force than we've seen in any time in the previous 22 years. We then also had the 2022, when I started my tenure as DG of DIRCO, there was again a breach of Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, this time by Russia, on the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. Again, there was no armed attack by Ukraine, so the use of force by Russia was unlawful. Irrespective of the rationales that were put forward, that was our position. I think that was the position of the large part of the EU. And in our discussions with our colleagues, is the same principle stance that took place there should take place in every other situation. We also have, you mentioned, Anthony, the ICJ case. So you had the events of October 7th, where there was attacks by Hamas and other armed groups, but the response by Israel was, in our view, at that point, an unfolding genocide, and we were duty-bound under the Genocide Convention to approach the court. We always state to people, if you think it's genocide, you are duty-bound to prevent it. You have to invoke. It's not Article 1 and 2 of the Genocide Convention isn't discretionary. It's compelling. It says you must. Not you can or you should. If you're a signatory to the convention and you think that there may be a genocide unfolding, you're duty-bound. And the moment our president said it's an unfolding genocide, in line with many other UN experts, we were duty-bound to do that. And we saw the unfolding effects of not stopping what is happening there. We see what's happening in Sudan, where the UN has also said there may be an unfolding genocide emerging there. And the difficult issue there is that's two non-state actors de facto. So the military government, who is de facto in charge, is not recognized as the de facto government by the African Union, because they came through unconstitutional change of government, a coup in other words, and the RSF as well. But the International Criminal Court has got jurisdiction there. The ICJ may not have because of the issues of statehood, but the International Criminal Court and our minister at the Human Rights Council has urged for the ICC to actually sharpen in its investigations there. So I think that's the nature. So we've got the attack on the way states relate to each other in terms of business, trade, and development, but you also have an environment where the rules of what is permissible in terms of the use of force is, the guardrails are completely gone. I think if we just see the threats emerging on a day-to-day basis, we should all be scared in terms of who can be next, what stops any particular country anywhere from being subjected to the threat of the use of force. And we spoke earlier on around South Africa's national security strategy, but what this hegemon that we're speaking about is doing stems from their current national security strategy. It's very clear in the national security strategy that they are permitted to act in the way that they are acting. Okay. And it's about the Monroe Doctrine with an emphasis with the current president's influence. Now it's called the Donro document. But essentially it lays the basis for the US to act without regard for the UN and the norms of international law. So I'm just stating this is not an attack on the US, I'm just describing the situation as it is. And remember, the old Monroe Doctrine was to ensure that Europe does not interfere in the affairs of the Western Hemisphere. Yeah, so that restatement is important in the context of the relationship and the relationship that is under stress between the transatlantic partners. But it's not new. I think it's unprecedented in the scale and but I want to just point out that, you know, you had a window between the end of the World War II consensus, where there was, the UN was established, the institutions of the UN was established, including the Bretton Woods institutions. But there was always a level of the powerful, and that includes, at that point, China, Russia, and others, using these institutions that they were in control of to shape the world as they wished to shape it. The powerful have always sought to act outside of the accountability mechanisms that the rest of us are subjected to. So if you look at the key instruments of accountability, the powerful countries are not signatories to them, whether it's the Rome Statute or even some of the international agreements related to the rights of children, exactly. You know, anything that can interfere with what they see as their sovereign right to make decisions on without being held accountable by others is the norm amongst many of the powerful. Okay. I often use the example of when you come to realism and the icon of realism, which is the late Henry Kissinger. And he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in the 1970s for helping to negotiate a ceasefire in Vietnam. Now, this was a war that Kissinger had both helped to escalate and then helped to end. Okay. And that is not unique. I just mentioned that. It is a pattern where the powerful escalate, start wars, but are also the primary drivers of ending it. And they end it on their terms. Okay. And so this is the dominant global political culture. It's a culture that, it's called a martial culture. It's a culture that celebrates war, celebrates those who wage war. And it's in contrast to a different culture that Jonathan Schell talks about and writes about in a book called The Unconquering World, where he talks about the opposing culture of that focuses on peace and serenity. And he mentions, you know, who the main actors of that are historically. You know, going back to biblical times, he mentions the fact that Jesus Christ was perhaps the most notable icon of this particular culture. And then he mentions a few others that I'm not going to mention. But the point is that this culture has always been much weaker than the martial culture, which is dominant. And in today's world, that martial culture is perhaps at its apex. And the consequences of it being at its apex is something that we need to confront. Okay? And when I say that it's at its apex, we're witnessing what's happening in Palestine, Lebanon, Iran, Ukraine, the Sudan. We can go on. The Augustan tradition that sanctions and glorifies violence, plunder, and exploitation is more dominant than it has been in recent decades. The question then for us is not just for South Africa, but for many others is, can we or should we mobilize around the other tradition, the other human tradition of peace that is centered on justice and inequality, and how do we do that? How do we do that where it is seen as a foreign policy approach, which is seen as quixotic? So often when we talk about we are anti-war, pro-peace, and then we are told we are unrealistic, particularly now. And we see the pressures on countries to spend more on defense. So with the 5% issue for NATO countries, but even South Africans are now being asked, should we not be spending more of our budget on defense? Should we not be building up the capabilities, not just our economic capabilities, but our military capabilities? And if we are asking that question, I can guarantee you many, many other countries in the region are asking the very same question, which means that resources, just not just money, but human resources, schools of thought, entire institutions that could have been geared towards development, peace, working together, is and can be directed to defense. But defense is easily translated into attack. We are asked as South Africa, why are we not more of a hegemon in the region? Why are you a reluctant hegemon? Why do you allow your neighbors who are smaller than you to disagree with you on certain foreign policy issues? It doesn't happen, they say, in West Africa or East Africa, where pivot states will determine, allegedly, if we don't say yes, you can't move. And we've discussed this for the last 3 or 4 years, and we are not going to become a hegemon in the region. We will continue to seek to work collaboratively with our neighbors and others, because if we move away from a stance that privileges peace, development, and cooperation in the region, it becomes a lot more dangerous. And if the globe goes that way, it becomes a lot more dangerous. And I think that's why the stance taken by President Sanchez on the issue of military expenditure versus development expenditure is an outlier in his region, but it's one that we resonate with, and we think we need to engage with more. So for this to be successful, and you know, there was a notion, I think it was Clausewitz who wrote about the frictionless war. And a frictionless war just means a war without any breaks, where there is no international norms that determines, firstly, when is it just to engage in war? And secondly, once you engage in war, what are the rules of war? The rules of war are regarded as frictions for a total war. And a lot of the international legal architecture is built on those frictions. And we need to elevate those frictions. And we need to put diplomacy as part of that friction. We need to put politics and engagement as part of those frictions. Not just what is the way to conduct yourself in war. Because we can see that it's being disregarded, and the ability to police those who disregard it, if it's the powerful doing it, is... There's no, that's one of the weaknesses in the international legal regime, there is no means to hold those most powerful and their friends accountable. The weaker get held accountable at an individual level or through sanctions, often unilateral sanctions, which are also unlawful, but the powerful can act with impunity. Okay. And we've seen that. I'm not going to go into the details on the differential treatment where certain presidents with warrant of arrest are prohibited from traveling, and justly so, and others are welcomed and given standing ovations. Same institutions, same warrant of arrest, same countries, generally. So I won't go into the details of that. So how do we, and I'll conclude, because I think there's going to be a lot more in terms of the question and answers. What do we need to do? The discussions that we've had in cabinet, there's going to be more discussions in the government of national unity, is that our foreign policy, which privileges peace, privileges dialogue, is essentially anti-war, is not the worst policy in the current space. In fact, it may be more necessary than ever. We need to work with others to ensure that we sort of build momentum around that. And these discussions are happening. So Mark Carney spoke about the need for middle powers to start talking to each other in Davos. South Africa and Finland co-hosted a side event at the UN in 2023 around middle powers needing to come together. We then already felt that, given the fact that we recognize that accountability is not something that the big powers pay a lot of attention to, that middle powers, and we can always talk about how you define those middle powers, it's a topic for another discussion, we felt needed to come together, because what holds us together is respect for international law, generally respect for human rights, and we all feel that the UN Charter and the institutions that underpins it and supports it should be reformed, yes, because they're definitely not perfect, but they should be protected and strengthened, because without these guardrails, we are all at risk. So we welcome the fact that since then, many more prominent leaders from big countries are making the same noises. And we feel that we cannot actually engage as South Africa alone in this space. We have to engage with others. And this idea of middle powers coming together across the kind of political blocks that we are used to is as important now as it was in 2022. So we're going to be working with others on that. So we're working with the Canadians. We're talking to colleagues in this room around some of these initiatives. So perhaps to conclude is the push for us to become more realist, engage in real politic, and also, as some have suggested, keep your head down. is not what we would propose. Keeping your head down is tantamount to appeasement. And the folly of appeasement in the years between 1936 and 1939 is one that history has told us, showed us. You cannot appease the kinds of hegemons who are disregard for international laws, norms, and human rights, because they will in any way do as they please. What is necessary is to build a collective of states and ideas who work on the institutions that will protect us all. So that's the approach that we're taking. It's not quixotic. The challenge for us is to be more consistent. And we've been accused of being inconsistent. And at points when we go through the history, we can point where we've been inconsistent in international law. But for the last 9 years, we've decided let's focus more where possible on deciding on an issue. Is it right? Is it wrong? Not only is it strategic. And often that is the approach that is taken. Is it strategic? And then you find ways of rationalizing what is right and what is wrong. So, we can go into, for example, voting records, even with Ukraine and Russia. When we voted for the resolution on Ukraine 2 years ago, it's because it met all our ticking boxes. We abstained before because We agreed with everything that talked about sovereignty and the protection of Ukraine's sovereignty. What we did not agree with was that you could do that through more war. The last resolution that we could vote for ticked all the boxes because the first line, the preambular paragraphs, said we need an unconditional ceasefire. The implication there was you cannot end this through more war. And then it went on to put in place the agreements that South Africa and others have been engaging with on what is known as the Zelensky peace plan on the protection of Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and integrity. Because it had all those boxes, we could vote yes for it. Interestingly enough, some of the countries that were with us on territorial integrity before then abstained on their own resolution because of the territorial integrity issue specifically. One of the big powers felt that actually the UN Charter's prohibition on the annexation of land through the use of force should not be in the text. And that was similar in the last resolution on Ukraine. So we've become a lot more consistent. Our explanation of votes indicate that. But if we're going to become a real champion on this, consistency is what's going to be what makes us fail or succeed in this. And so we're very conscious about the need to be a lot more consistent and to look at each resolution, each issue on its merits, and not just, are they our friends? Are they not our friends? Because you determine friendship in various different ways. We have many friends, and not all our friends are engaging in actions in the international space that we can agree with. But we need to take decisions that is based on our own mandating environment, which is the Constitution in the first instance, and then international law in the second instance. And that includes the entire International Bill of Rights. So that is the approach that we would like to follow, and that's the approach that we're discussing with the parties in the GNU. That's the approach that we've discussed with Cabinet a week ago. I can deal with some of the other issues in question and answer. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dangle. If we could begin with questions from the media at the front here. Paul.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I have it.
Paul Vecchio from Bloomberg. The one thing you haven't mentioned is South Africa's the trajectory of South African relations with the United States. You've talked about, and at the moment we've had no South African ambassador to Washington for quite a while now. How far is the government or the presidency about to announce a candidate? There was a report by a columnist saying somebody had been chosen, but no announcement's been made yet. So if you can just give us an idea on that, please. Thank you.
Let's take one more from here.
Thank you, DG. beg your pardon. Babalo from EWN. I'm just following up on Paul's question on US-South Africa relations. There's been a lot of speculation about us being disinvited to G7 as a guest or an observer, as well as Minister Enoch Godongwana not attending this G20 gathering of finance ministers. The G7, was that at the behest of Marco Rubio or the Trump administration, or is it just a misunderstanding, or is that not the complete story? And is it a case of riding out the current regime or Trump administration until the next election cycle, or is South Africa really seriously concerned about these tensions between the US, or is it overly exaggerated?
Taking those two questions. So in terms of the ambassador, what I can say is the president has made a decision. What I can't tell you is the name until all the formalities are completed. So there will be an ambassador appointed quite soon, and it'll be the kind of person I think ideally suited for that environment. And then, so bear with me, I mean, there's certain protocols that one can't breach until it's been signed and dotted. In terms of the overall relations, I mean, we've been engaging with the U.S. I mean, I've been going, ministers have been going, we've sent delegations, and trade negotiations have been continuing. And the relationship and the negotiating issues move from initially being three baskets of issues, a domestic basket, a foreign policy basket, a trade basket. And the most important issue unresolved is the domestic basket. That is the key issue that we are still engaging with them on, and that's how we're going to get an ambassador to engage with those issues. And it's really the issues you see in the public domain about redress policies. That is the sticking point at the moment. The G7, you know, France is the president of the G7 at the moment. We are not a member of the G7. We do get invited occasionally as a guest country to be at the G7. They're having a scaled-down meeting this year in Avian, and they've decided that in terms of keeping it scaled down, that they will invite Kenya, who's actually hosting the Africa-France summit this year. And they were hoping that we would be working with them on that. And I've been engaging with my counterpart, who is the G20 and G7 Sherpa, and might be meeting with him in person in the next couple of days. France is actually quite concerned about the fact, and they've said this to us, and they've said it publicly. So we are not a guest of the we're not a member of the G7, we're a guest. And there is a prerogative not to invite us. And it's happened before. When Japan was the president at the presidency of the G7, we were not invited. It's not something you fight about if you're a guest country. We were the G20 president, and we invited many guests, including all the guests that were invited by Brazil. But we, you know, there's many others who would have loved to be invited, but we could not do that. So the fact that we are not part of the G20 is in fact a breach of the rules of the G20. Because we are not a guest country in the G20. We are a full member of the G20. You know, there's permanent guests in the G20. Some of them may be in the room, Spain, you know, the Netherlands are almost permanent guests, but some of them were left out, for example, from either the Brazilian presidency or the Indian presidency. We make sure that we keep all the permanent guests in because of the influence that they bring. So France is going to raise this at the next meeting of Sherpas, that we are not. It was raised at the first meeting of Sherpas that we were not there. It was not resolved. It will be raised at the next meeting of the Sherpas again, because it does call into question the status of this particular G20. Is it a full G20? Can you call it a G20 declaration if you have it? If a guest, it doesn't self-exclude, as was the case last year, but is actively excluded. So this is going to be a discussion. You know, you've had countries at war in this period who were not excluded, and they are full G20 members, because you can only be excluded by consensus of all the members of the G20 that decides that in a particular year you cannot engage. So this is still a subject for discussion. So we're still engaging quite actively with the community of states in the G20. So we're actively engaging with, we're having a meeting with the UK tomorrow just on, you know, key issues that they may need to take up that we started coming from the Italian, Indonesian, Indian, Brazilian presidencies that we feel may need to be taken up by the UK from an implementation perspective, because there's a bit of a gap this year. But we're also engaging with other G20 members on key issues of discussion on that. So I don't think that we must make a big issue about the fact that we're not in Evian this year.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question as well?
Nancy Ferrara from News 24. I wanted to ask what you think the significance is of Viktor Orban's... Is it not on?
Anthony, you're answering that.
Can I go? MC from News 24, I wanted to ask how you saw the significance of Viktor Orban's defeat on Europe's attempts to negotiate an end to the conflict in Ukraine. And then if I may, perhaps less happily, what do you make of the collapse of the Iran-US peace talks, and how do you think that impacts on the Gulf states for now?
Thanks, TG. Could I ask you, Peter Fabricius from Daily Maverick, you mentioned discussions in the GNU. Are the main members or all the members of the GNU on the same page as far as foreign policy is concerned? Because there have been some concerns about Russia, China, whatever, Iran maybe. And could I ask you, I mean, there were some reports that we have been given a sort of free passage through Strait of Hormuz by Iran. Is there any truth to that? What is our status in terms of that kind of passage and our relations with Iran and in current circumstances? Thank you.
Thanks. MZ, can I ask the European colleagues to answer the Orban question? Right? No, look, I think it may provide for more just an outsider to the EU dynamics, but it may provide a more unified approach from within the European Union on how to deal with the conflict. I think that there was certain issues that the current president would not support. Let's see how that pans out. I really don't want to go into the details of, you saw that when the president gave his credential ceremony the other day, and he basically said what he expects of his ambassadors that he sends out. I think it's an important issue. I think it's a win for democratization, and I always say that rather a messy democracy than a perfect autocracy. It's a personal position than one that I engage in with my colleagues. Peter, on the collapse of the negotiations, what we do see is that there was, and this is basically just reports that we all pick up through diplomatic chatter though, is that there was movement towards a meeting of the minds on key issues. And then at the last minute, maximalist issues were put on the agenda, particularly around the enrichment issue. If you go back to the JCPOA, which was the agreement on nuclear that was negotiated by President Obama, it had basically put in place with the ability of member states of the IAEA and the UN to monitor it through the technical experts, that there will be no enrichment to the level necessary for non-scientific, up until for 40 years. So that was put in place. And I think Oman, in their negotiations, before the use of force by the US and Israel, had indicated that Iran had already agreed to similar conditions in their negotiations with Oman. So it appears that at the last minute, some maximalist positions around enrichment torpedoed the negotiations. Peter, I think that, the GNU will continue to discuss and many of the differences will be aired out, but I think for the very first time, both in cabinet, but also through a presentation that we were asked to do as resource people to them, there's a discussion taking place about what is acceptable. And what appears to be laying the basis for agreement is the Constitution and respect for international law in all instances.
Okay, thank you. Marion.
I'm Marion Edmonds from Carte Blanche. I'm just going to move away from your topic and ask you about something else which is of interest. Durko was very involved in locating and extracting South Africans who'd ended up in the Russian war earlier this year, and something which was almost quite a miraculous feat. Are you able to give us an insight into how Durko managed to do that, given the tensions around that particular issue and the involvement of the Zuma family? And could you also explain or give us some insight as to whether Durko is going to help the Botswanan parent who's lost a child and his childhood friend who went as part of that group, also allegedly recruited by Duduzile Zuma Sambudla, who seems to be forgotten. The others have come back, but these two young men are still missing, and the mother does not know to whom she can turn.
Perhaps one more.
Thanks. Just on, I was going to ask you about the Canadian initiative, but I'm glad you've answered that. I understand that foreign policy is an uncomfortable mixture of interests and values, with a big dose of hypocrisy, given the role that interests play. But I don't understand the relationship South Africa has taken towards Iran, even after the human rights violations of earlier this year, and although, of course, Trump's figure of 45,000 dead was just a thumbsuck, but there were human rights protesters who were killed, and South Africa didn't. But despite that, South Africa's interests and values are neither especially obvious in the relationship with Iran, and yet it seems to be so close we go out of our way to have them participate in our military events and visits there, and favourable comments about them. Even though, of course, they weren't part of the struggle, the Ayatollah did deals with the apartheid government, as I'm sure you know.
Thank you. Please go on.
So, Marion, I think we did engage with the Russians in the main through diplomatic channels to ensure that we get those, and we'll talk about how they got there, back safely. We also had to engage with the Ukrainians to ensure that they play their role as well where possible. But they were in the Russian front line, so it was mostly the Russians that we had to engage with. on working with getting others back from Botswana and other parts of Africa, we do work with those governments as well, just to the extent that we can lend support. But they are engaging on their own as well to try and get them back. You know, the issue is that investigations need to take place. Normally, if people join an army like this on their own accord, it's against our laws and there'll be mercenaries. But if they were trafficked, that's another investigation space that needs to take place. So the law enforcement agencies are looking at that now. Is if they are trafficked, then the investigations must detail who did the trafficking, who was involved on both sides of yeah. And then your question on Iran and interest. So you know our interests are, like you said, it's, you know, there's military interest, political interest, economic interests, and there's values. And often, not all of these values sit comfortably with all the states that we have engagements with. You know, Pretoria has got the second highest number of embassies and international organizations after Washington D.C. And not all of those states present in our space and that we engage with will be in sync with everything that we feel are important. We did criticize Iran's approach to the protesters, and there was a resolution at the UN that we were engaging with others on that in the end we could not vote yes on, because we wanted in place an independent inquiry that will look at the totality of what happened. Because there was also indications, and a lot of those indications are now getting more traction, that some of the protesters may have been armed. But we said we criticized Iran
for human rights abuses, and we stressed the fact that freedom of association and expression is very important for us, and that all those who protest on any issue must be given the space to protest without being subjected to, you know, arrests or violence. But we wanted an independent. That was not agreed to by all the parties involved in that resolution, and we had to make a statement on that as part why we abstained and put an explanation of vote, because we felt that that would be critically important. But it's one of those that we have to engage with every single state in the same way. You know, there's you know, it's not only Iran. It's
we don't bring every state into our
yep.
military waters.
So as you know, that there was there's an inquiry being set up because there was instruction that this should not take place, and the president has set up an inquiry as to why did it take place despite the instruction.
So that's not policy.
It wasn't a policy that was agreed to.
While I'm waiting for more hands, can I just ask a follow-up on the role of the president in foreign policy? You've mentioned him a number of times. I wondered how important is a president in driving foreign policy? And just making the observation that you resigned from government under Jacob Zuma, and you have spoken positively about a law and rule-driven approach, which is very consistent with Ramaphosa's thinking. And maybe alongside that, is there a danger to the consistency that you've talked about with a change of president in the near future? And could we also get a question from Mark?
Thank you, Mark Novitz. You mentioned that we have in South Africa a huge diplomatic corps. And I've been involved in diplomacy in South Africa for many, many years. And the common complaint of ambassadors and consul generals is that they come very enthusiastic and after 3 months realize that they're going to get absolutely nowhere and then sit out the remainder of their term. And the reason is that whatever they try to do, Durko is a stumbling block. And the best example for me, since I have been the Consul General of Peru for the last 8 years, is we've been trying to deal with the issue of trade and reduction in tariffs and promote bilateral trade. And when I talk to my colleagues from Europe or from Asia, in each and every instance, the stumbling block is always Durko, so that the word cooperation in the Durko title doesn't seem to exist, because for 25 years, the promised trade deal that would result in a reduction of tariffs hasn't materialized. So either South Africa wants friends, and people view South Africa as important, which is why the diplomatic corps is as large as it is in South Africa, or quite simply, it doesn't want friends, in which case people should rethink their whole approach to South Africa.
Okay, so I think the first question is the role of the president. So there's a constitutional link to that. The constitution states that foreign policy is the prerogative of the executive, and the executive is led by the president and includes other cabinet members, and then, of course, now with the Foreign Services Act in place, led by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. But the president has been leading from the front, and he's been quite constant on the rule of law issues. I mean, you've seen, for example, changes in voting patterns linked to Myanmar and other places, largely led by his intervention. So he's been leading from the front on these issues. And what happens after that, we can only hope that there's continuity.
Are there no mechanisms that can be put in place to encourage continuity,
look,
consistency?
I think let me put it to you this way. When you talk about voting records at the UN Human Rights Council, there's an I always say to my colleagues that any diplomat who represents the flag is bound by the Constitution, Section 8 of the Constitution. You are bound by the Constitution. You cannot and should not go unless there's a rational reason for breaching any issue that's in contravention of the Bill of Rights. And that has been something that we've been building on that. That should guide us as diplomats, active in the field. And the president has been supporting that, but he can only support that because not only because of his personal position, but also because there's a positive duty to do that. And I think that is the guardrail that civil society and others should be holding us to whoever's in charge to account on. I think, Mark, are you saying you're the CG of Peru? Yes. Okay. I think we should have a one-on-one on what the challenges is, because you may find you may find that there's different views and opinions, and maybe the discussions that you're having with colleagues is not coming to me. Maybe they're being polite. But we should have a one-on-one to figure out what can be done. And, you know, so that we can play a facilitative role where legally necessary and possible.
Okay. If you take cooperation out of DIRCO, you get D-I-R-E. Just mentioning that. Any further? Yes.
I would just like to ask if Foreign Affairs would support the idea of payment through the Strait of Hormuz.
And we have one more here.
I'm not sure the link between DTIC and DIRCO on the African Free Trade Agreement, but I'm just wondering where that stacks in your priorities.
That's it? Okay. I think, look, for us, the important issue is that the war must end. The Strait of Hormuz was opened before the war. That should be the status, and you can only get there if the conflict ends. There is already a situation where some ships are allowed to pass without necessarily having to pay. But tolling the Strait of Hormuz is against the laws of the seas, and we would not be supportive of that. So we would rather having a situation where the war ends and you get back to a situation where it was open 2 months ago. DTIC, we work very closely together now in the last couple, 2 years more than we have before. I think there is a need to diversify trading partners and not to be too reliant on certain markets only, which is not something that we are only doing. You know, there's a global move towards that. The AFCFTA is absolutely important in that because, you know, intra-African trade is so small. And we need to get to the point where we up it. I mean, in SADC alone, it's at 18%. East Africa is higher at about 28%, but you can just shift. The higher end is at 28%. Then the AFCFTA is vitally important for us to ensure that we get new markets on the continent and we can get new product lines, that we can, you know, get to markets in Africa, but also about interdependent supply chains and critical issues like medicines and the kind of critical minerals necessary for the green economy. So we're working very closely with DTIC on the operationalization of the AFCFTA, obviously, within the African Union.
Okay, thank you. And we have one from Sheila Camara.
Thank you, DG. You were saying that the use of force is becoming almost acceptable, and you listed a number of examples, like the attacks on Iran, Iran's attacks on its neighbors, Russia's attacks on Ukraine, and then you mentioned Israel's attacks. Subsequent to the Hamas attacks on Israel, but you didn't contextualize the Hamas attack. And I wondered if you'd like to just go into a bit more detail as to where you see that attack fitting in response to Israel's. Thanks.
I think that's the last question.
So if you look at our application before the ICJ, and also the application that we, together with five other states, did to the International Criminal Court, we put forward the following, that given the Geneva Conventions and the protocols thereto, oppressed people have the right to armed resistance, but under the Geneva Conventions, they cannot attack civilians, and that's why in our own application to the ICJ, we mentioned that investigations for war crimes must be levied against Hamas and other armed groups on October 7th, not taking away from the fact that the Geneva Conventions, arising from a decision linked to South Africa's occupation of Namibia, points out that oppressed people have the right to use arms, but governed by the Geneva Conventions. And that's why we made those applications. We go further in our application that says that the very same law of occupations does not give Israel the right to self-defense against an occupied people. And even if you give them that right, the right to self-defense is never a defense against genocide. And that's the approach that we've taken.
Take a glass for you.
Yeah, I need more water.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dango. I wonder, before you go, we have a tradition of giving our speakers something in a brown envelope. Thank you very much, Mr. Dango. Never know what you're going to get.
That's right.
You could be worse.
Thank you.